Yeah, I'd like to say thank God. Leave some space for me at the end. Okay, so in particular, a lot of the work I'm going to talk about is inspired a lot by the work that Furstenberg and his school has done. Although I won't really directly use any of his work, more sort of the ideas. Okay, so this is all joint work of Ben Green. I'm going to talk about the title, I guess I should put it, is the Mobius No Sequences Conjecture. I'll explain what this conjecture is. So there are two papers on this. There's one on the archive already, and one that we're finishing basically this week. So this question is motivated by two separate or two related issues in two problems in number theory involving the primes. So one of them, the one that originally motivated us, was trying to solve linear equations in primes. So you have some set of linear equations in some unknowns, and you want to solve those equations where the unknowns are all prime. For example, the Goldbach problem is trying to solve, given even number n, can you solve this equation, p1 plus p2 equals n, with p1 and p2 both prime? That's the even Goldbach problem, and that's conjectured to be true for all n, even n bigger than 4. And then there's the odd Goldbach problem, which is the same thing. If any odd number bigger than whatever it is, 7 or something, then they should be able to solve this equation. Or ethnic regressions. For example, if you can find infinitely many solutions to this equation, then you have found infinitely many progressions of primes of length 3. You make things non-trivial. Or if you want to solve a pair of equations, okay, and again with some non-triviality condition. If you can find infinitely many solutions to these to this system, then you have found infinitely many ethnic progressions of primes length 4, and so on and so forth. Okay, so it would be nice to have a general theory to know when you can solve these equations and when you can't. So there are some obvious obstructions. Let me just add one more. Okay, so the most famous one, perhaps, most famous equation that we all would like to solve is the twin prime conjecture. There should be infinitely many solutions to this equation. Okay, so not every system is solvable. So there are two obvious obstructions to solvability. So one is sort of the Archimedean obstruction. Okay, it's a fancy name for something very simple, but okay. Okay, you can't solve these equations if there aren't any solutions in the positive integers. Okay, so I can't solve this equation. All right, for instance. So one necessary condition to solve a system like this is that you should have many solutions in positive integers. Okay, so let us say that there's no Archimedean obstruction if there are infinitely many solutions in the positive integers. Okay, or actually you need a four-dimensional space of in the positive integers. Okay, and then there are the mod p obstructions. Actually, let's call mod q. Okay, and those come from the fact that the primes tend to be co-prime to numbers. Okay, so they tend to be odd. They tend to be co-prime to 3, co-prime to 5, with of course one exception for each. Okay, but as a consequence, it's very hard to solve certain equations because they have obstructions. Right? For example, you cannot solve this. Well, you can find one solution to this equation. Okay, but in primes, so of course there are no Archimedean obstructions here, but there's a mod 2 obstruction because primes are all odd with one exception. You can do similar things. So there's mod 3. There are equations that are not solvable because of mod 2, mod 3, mod 5 obstruction, and so forth. Okay, so there's a general conjecture, which is Dixon's conjecture, which is that essentially these are the only two obstructions. Okay, so that if there are no Archimedean obstructions. Now. I need this in actually a strong sense. I said not only is it solvable in integers, but I need infinitely many solutions in the integers and a full rank space of solutions in the integers, in the positive integers. Okay, so I also can't solve this equation Okay, even though it is strictly technically solvable, okay, I need an infinite number of solutions. But okay, so I won't quite clarify this, but okay, I won't detail this. But if there are no Archimedean obstructions and no more P obstructions, okay, then there should be infinitely many solutions to a linear system. Okay, and so this is the qualitative version of the Dixon conjecture. There is a more quantitative version where you only consider solutions for primes up to some large number n, and depending on what these you can quantify how mod p obstructed you are using something called a singular series, and you can count the number of positive integer solutions. And there is a prediction that they make as to an asymptotic for how many solutions you're going to have in primes up to n. So the more precise version of this conjecture, which I will not state here, it's actually sort of similar to the G and G tilde numbers that was in Liu's talk last afternoon, actually. Okay, so it would be wonderful if we could solve this conjecture, because we could that would imply the twin prime conjecture. It would morally imply the Goldbach conjecture for sufficiently large n. My theorem of Bennett, the arbitrary long ethnic progressions is also implied, but many, many other results could be implied. So, okay, we have not proved this conjecture, but it's certainly one of our main motivations. The other related motivation is that of distribution of functions of primes mod 1. So you can ask what the primes are doing. So one way to study the primes is to take various functions of the primes and ask what they're doing, and in particular, functions mod 1 is a particularly useful thing to study. So for example, almost all primes are odd. So if you take P over 2 mod 1, this sequence is all concentrated at 1/2. Okay. And more generally, if you have alpha P mod 1. When alphas are rational, then on the unit circle, that would just be distributed if alpha is, say, A over Q. That would distribute it in all the numbers B over Q, where B is co-prime to Q. Okay, that's Dirichlet's theorem, and in fact, the prime number theorem in ethnic progressions tells you that, in fact, this sequence is, in fact, equidistributed among all those points that are co-prime to Q. Okay, but then now suppose alphas are rational. So take the same thing, but now alpha is not rational. Okay, then what happens now is that in this case there's no here again there's also sort of local obstruction that stops you from spreading out everywhere, but once you are more probably irrational, like I say root 2 p mod 1, then it's a theorem. It goes back at least to Davenport, probably earlier, that these numbers are also equidistributed. This sequence is equidistributed mod 1. So what that means is that if you count the number of primes up to n, so say alpha p mod 1 lies in some interval inside the unit circle, then and you divide that by the total number of primes less than n, then this actually converges as n goes infinity to the measure of this interval for any interval. Okay, that's the definition of equidistribution. Okay, so that's the theorem. There are similar results, for example, alpha p squared mod 1. Okay, you take a prime squared. If you multiply them by a rational number, then again there are local obstructions, and they will only get distributed on some finite set. But if there are no local obstructions, so if you take, for example, root 2p mod 1, root 2p squared, it is again a theorem that sequences like this are equidistributed. And more generally, if you take any polynomial of a prime mod 1, if all the non-constant coefficients are rational, there's a local obstruction, there would be a finite orbit. But if there are no local obstructions, then it is a theorem that these are equidistributed. These get harder and harder to prove. You have to bound these vowel sums, and by methods not too dissimilar from what was in the previous talk, actually. You can keep going. Here's another thing you could do. Take root 2p, an integer part, root 3p mod 1. Okay, So this is some funny number. Is this guy uniformly distributed mod 1? Okay, there's sort of no obvious local obstruction for this. Okay, but all right, but okay, and you can keep going. Okay, so you can imagine. So this type of expression is called it's not a polynomial in P because of the least integer part function. But this is what's called a bracket polynomial, a combination of multiplication, addition. Oh, yeah, let's make it complicated here. Like that. Okay. Okay. Is this guy uniformly distributed mod 1? Okay, it's already forget primes. Just to do this for natural numbers, it's already a little bit tricky. All right, so that's a question. So one of our results is that the answer to that question is yes. Okay. So if you want to solve equity distribution, we know from Val that what you should do is you should do Fourier analysis, and what you should in fact do is start looking at sums like this. Okay, so if you want alpha p mod 1, for instance, you should study these exponential sums where e of course is this function. Okay, you also want to study alpha p squared and alpha p fraction of part beta p and so forth. Okay, and so there are trivial bounds on this thing. Okay, you can always bound this by the total number of primes less than n. Okay, which is roughly n log n, prime number theorem. Okay, but whenever you can get non-trivial bounds on exponential sums, anything which is just a little bit better than the trivial bounds, in fact, just little o is often enough, then that will give you results of equity distribution. And in fact, if you have very good bounds, for example, maybe if you can save some sort of power gain out of here, then you get a very good type of equity distribution. You get some very good control on the rate of convergence. But I won't discuss that here. But anyway, the point is that you start wanting to deal with sums like this, and not coincidentally, the same type of sums appear also when you want to solve these sort of problems. The reason basically is that these problems are connected because if things like this were not equidistributed, then that could create, in principle, a further obstruction to solving linear equation primes that beyond the obvious of Archimedean and Mod Q obstructions. Okay. For example, take root 2p mod 1. Okay. Mod 1, sorry. This number. Okay, it's a theorem that it's equidistributed mod 1, but suppose it wasn't. Okay, so suppose, for instance, that all the primes multiplied by root 2 mod 1 somehow decided to have all have fraction of part between 0 and 0.1. Okay, now that would be very weird. Okay, it doesn't happen, but suppose it did. If that happened, that would imply, for instance, yeah. So let's say all but finitely many of these guys of these numbers, meaning that here, that would imply, for instance, that there are only finitely many solutions to the trim prime conjecture. Because if this was true, of course, root 2 p1 minus root 2 p2 is equal to 2 root 2 mod 1. And this is between 0 and 0.1. This is between 0 and 0.1. This is, oh, please, let me hit this right. Okay, so, it's 0.8 something. Okay, if I set it up correctly, this there's no way you can subtract these two and get this. Okay, so the point is that lack of equity distribution can obstruct solutions to linear equations. Okay, this is a very simple example, but you can cook up more fancy examples. Lack of equity distribution of this guy will create trouble for progression to length 4 because of the following. So let me write it a little bit differently. All right, suppose you want to find a progression length 4 in the primes. So If you take root 2a squared, root 2 a plus r squared, root 2 a plus 2 r squared, and root 2 a plus 3 r squared, mod 1. These numbers are not, if these guys are in progression, these numbers are constrained. There's an identity, which you can check, that this expression, which is basically the third derivative of root 2 x squared, is 0. And it's also 0 mod 1. And hence, if there's some ill distribution as to these guys mod 1, It turns out that won't actually destroy the number of progressions. In fact, there's a famous theorem already that tells you that that it's actually very hard to get to actually eliminate progressions from a set. But what it will do is that it will distort the count, the asymptotic, that it will influence the number of progressions of them four in the primes, and it will be off from the expected value. So it doesn't that obstruction doesn't directly affect the qualitative Dickson's conjecture, but it does affect the quantitative Dickson's conjecture, in which you talk about asymptotics for how many solutions you have, which I'm not going to write down here. But okay, so that I just wanted to give you some examples to convince you that understanding this problem is a necessary first step before you can start understanding this problem. But the great thing is that it appears that that in many situations the converse is true as well. That if you have good equidistribution results here, then you can get you can solve these problems. So for example, the circle method, you want to solve, for example, this problem here, the Goldbach problem, or finding progressions on 3, the circle method works very well, and what it tells you is that you can solve, you can count the solutions to this guy if you know how to estimate something like that. Okay? And so we are interested in sums of this form. Yeah, okay. Yeah, exponential sums in the primes. Now, it's hard to work with the primes directly, it's more convenient to work with various proxies for the primes. So one particularly convenient proxy is the von Mangold function. The von Mangold function is a function of integers. It's defined as log p, when n is the power of a prime, and 0 otherwise. So it's essentially counting the primes. It's big when you're prime, and you're 0 when you're not prime. This function is better to do than the primes because it obeys better identities. So, for example, one nice property that you have is that if you sum up all the lambda d, all d's dividing in n, that's the same as log n. This is a restatement fundamental theorem of arithmetic. And in fact, this can be taken as the definition of lambda of d. Or if you take the not quite the Fourier transform, but the Mellon transform of this statement, an equivalent form of this is that you have this nice identity that the Dirichlet series of lambda is given is expressed in terms of the Riemann zeta function. Okay, so in particular, if you know something about the zeros of this guy, you can tell a lot about primes, but that's a whole other story. So instead of sums like this, it's actually a little bit better. No, okay, it's actually a little bit better to deal with questions like this. You know, and again, you can replace this by alpha n squared, you know, or alpha n fractional part, beta root n, and so forth. Okay, so forth. And you'd like to get non-trivial bounds on this expression here. Okay. So, for Ben and I, we found that okay. So lambda is pretty nice to do with, but there are even better functions that you can play with. So there are some more identities concerning this von Mangold function. For example, you can write this von Mangold function in terms of as the Dirichlet convolution of the Mobius function and the log function. So where the Mobius function is defined to be minus 1 to the k when d is the product of k distinct primes and 0 otherwise. Okay? This identity, by the way, in terms of Dirichlet series, is equivalent to the fact that this function is equal to 1 over c times minus 1 over c prime. No, minus c prime, sorry. Okay, that's a convolutions transform to pointwise product when you take Fourier or Mellon transforms. Okay, so because of this identity, if you insert that into here and you do some rearrangement, in principle, okay, it's not completely, it's a slight lie, but if you want to estimate sums like this, it essentially suffices to control sums like this. Okay, and again, with generalizations. Okay. Okay. Now, why is this more pleasant to deal with? Well, one nice thing is that see, this function lambda is very spiky. Right? If you plot it, you know, it's big on primes and zero on the other primes, on non-primes. Its average value is 1. But it's usually below average. It's usually 0, and occasionally it's quite a bit above average. It's an unbounded function. Whereas the Mobius function is much more well-behaved, well, as far as magnitude is concerned. Okay. I mean, it oscillates like crazy. Not in a regular way, okay, but but just by definition, it only takes values 0, 1, or minus 1. So that's one thing. The other thing is that this guy, the Mobius function, is much more equidistributed than the Mangold function. So we saw that because the primes tend to be odd, co-prime to 3 and so forth, they tend to have a lot of local structure, which distorts a lot of these sums. So, for example, so this sum, okay, so you want to ask, when does this sum have a trivial bound? Okay, so you can of course bound this in magnitude by the full sum, and in some cases, like for when alphas are rational, there's a lot of cancellation then, and then this expression is a lot smaller than this expression. But if alpha is rational, then in fact you don't get much cancellation, and this expression is in fact quite large, and it does not decay like little o of this guy over here. For example, if alpha is 1/2, then because primes are almost all odd, e to 1/2 n is almost always minus 1. And in fact, in magnitude, this guy is in fact almost exactly equal to the right-hand side. So for rational numbers, so when alpha is rational, or very close to rational, if alpha lies in what's called a major arc, then this expression is very large. And if alpha is not close to a rational with small denominator, what's called a minor arc, then it is very small. So, I mean, that theory has been worked out by Hardy and Leroux and Vinogradov and all these people, and it's more developed. But it gets harder if you start doing alpha n squared. Okay, so there is still the same story. If alpha is rational, it doesn't decay. If alpha is irrational, then it does decay. But it gets harder and harder to work out what the major arcs and minor arcs are when you have more complicated expressions here. And so it begins to look rather messy. But so one of the reasons why we switched to the Mobius function is that the Mobius function has no obstructions. That the Mobius function is plus or minus 1, and for example, even odd numbers, just intuitively, you're just as likely to be plus or minus 1 for even numbers as you are for odd numbers. So I should first of all say from the prime number theorem, okay, so the first result I should mention is that it's already not obvious, but the average value of this actually goes to 0. So okay, so this average is actually goes to 0. Okay, so the plus or minus 1 with average with mean 0. I can multiply by 2, right? Mu of 2n is equal to minus mu of n as long as n was odd. And so it's actually not hard to show the same thing is true for 2n, 3n, 4n, and so forth. And you can, and more generally, if you use the prime number theorem in arithmetic regressions, on any residue class, so you just take all the n's that are 3 mod 10, okay, you can show that, again, the average value of this thing goes to 0. So, but what this means is that locally, it looks very uniformly, there are no local mod p obstructions of this thing being very uniformly distributed. Okay, in fact, you can even get fairly good control on this, that it decays reasonably fast, like it decays faster than any power logarithm up to a constant that depends on A and on this Q here. That's a theorem of Siegel and Wolpertz. One other annoying thing about this theorem, by the way, is that this theorem is true. So there's a constant here for every A, but no, there is no A for which we have an effective boundless constant. That is. Really? Okay. Okay, that is that. Okay, I thought you can only get log. Okay, that was not aware of. Okay, but okay, certainly for A large enough, okay, there's no effective bound known. The proof is indirect, so there's not. Okay, I'll ask you about that. Okay, didn't know that. Okay, but anyway, because of this, since no local obstructions, you should get decay on this thing regardless of whether alpha is rational or irrational. There should be a uniform bound. So, for example, Davenport showed, for instance, that this expression is indeed one of the average of this expression does indeed decay faster than any power of the logarithm uniformly in alpha. Rational or irrational does not matter. Okay, and with a bit more effort, you can also extend that to say alpha n squared and other polynomials. So we would like to do the same thing for like these bracket polynomials and so forth. Well, I should say why we care about these bracket polynomials. The reason why we care about these bracket polynomials is because these guys are also obstructions to certain of these linear equations. You see, so I told you before. So I had this constraint, which was supposed to convince you that the understanding the behavior of root 2 p squared mod 1 was important for progression of length 4. So there's a similar constraint involving bracket polynomials. You see, the thing is that mod x is x goes to integer part of x is not quite a linear function, but it's sort of almost a linear function in that linearity holds about half of the time. Okay, and as a consequence, like if I call it, let's say f of n to be root 2n fractional part root 3n, for instance, okay, then if you have an f equation on 4, then you can show just by applying this and hoping that you are on the 50% regime where you're right, that this expression should vanish about 1/16th of the time, I think, if I do. Okay, but a positive fraction of the time. And hence, if there is some irregularity with f of p mod 1, that will show that will influence the distribution influence the count as to how many progressions on the 4 there are. So if you want to answer the question of how many of getting the precise count as to how many progressions on the 4 or any sufficiently complicated system of equations of this type, you do need to understand first this problem of understanding distribution of things like this mod 1. Okay, so basically, any time there is a function which obeys some sort of constraint on arithmetic regressions, you know, some fraction of the time, we need to know how that function is distributed with respect to, say, the Möbius function before we can solve our linear equations and Feynman's problem. So, what are all the functions? So this then begs the question. So, what are all the functions which have constraints of this type, at least some of the time? So, happily, the ergodic theorists have answered this question for us, and in particular, including Furstenberg, but many other people as well. Well, they answered not exactly the question we needed, but close enough that it was convincing that this was the right answer. And so, in fact, the correct class of functions f, which have properties like this, and that when you do it, I call them null sequences. Okay, so what are null sequences? I'll first give you, so a null sequence is going to be a sequence of a bounded sequence of numbers, and so here are some examples. Actually, this guy's not quite a null sequence. This is a piecewise null sequence, but never mind that. But this is morally a null sequence. You have to smooth out the fractional part to make it an actual null sequence, or any combination of these things. So more generally, I can generalize this guy. I can take any function of alpha n, where f is a continuous function from the circle to, say, the complex numbers. Okay, so I can take sine of alpha n or whatever, any periodic function of alpha n, or I can take any periodic function of on a two torus, okay, or I can stick in a couple of these guys, okay, and so on and so forth. And anything like this, I want to call a null sequence. So the formal definition, okay, so these are examples. The formal definition is that a null sequence, this is actually what's called a basic null sequence. There's a whole hierarchy of these things, but a basic null sequence is any sequence of the form n. So f of n is defined to be a function of a group element acting on a point where g lies in a group, and this is a nilpotently group. This null is why we're null sequences. X is a point lying in a quotient space, g mod gamma, and so this is a discrete co-compact. I'll give you some examples of this. Subgroup, also called a uniform lattice. And okay, so g acts on x on the left because of the g over here, and f is just some function to say the complex numbers, and we'll either require this. So you can require this to either be piecewise continuous, in which case you get a piecewise null sequence, or continuous, in which case you get a continuous null sequence, or you can ask for a bit more regularity. For example, you can ask for Lipschitz regularity, in which case we call it a Lipschitz null sequence. Okay, so anything of this type is called a null sequence. So examples. Okay, so for example, e to the alpha n is the simplest example. Well, okay, well, 1 is the simplest example of no sequence. Okay, only 0 even simpler. But okay, but e to alpha n is the first interesting example. So here the group is the real line, the lattice is the integers, the function is the exponential function, and the group element is alpha. Okay, so acting so our group. Okay, so. You have to abuse notation and think of the additive operation here is actually acting multiplicatively. Okay, so that's the simplest example. This is an abelian null sequence, or what's called a one-step null sequence, because the underlying group is an abelian or one-step nilpotent group. What about e to the alpha n squared? You can't quite generate that from something as simple as this, but you can from a more complicated null system. So here, your group is one is part of the Heisenberg group. It's the group of upper triangular matrices with two real entries and one integer entry here. You can check that's a group. Inside it, there's a discrete compact subgroup. Okay, the quotient space can be written as a set of all x, y, where x and y live in the torus, where we identify any x, y with the matrix 1x, y, 0, 1, 1 times gamma. So you can show that all the cosets of gamma can be presented in this form. If you set alpha to be, g to be 1, 1, 1, 1, alpha, 0, this group element, and x is going to be the identity element, so the identity, okay, the origin. And f is the function that maps x, y to e of y. So basically what you're doing is that you're taking this g, you're raising it to the nth power, hitting this the identity, just doing nothing, and then applying this function f. If you do that, a little computation will show that your null sequence, in this case, is e to the alpha n plus 1, n minus 1 over n plus 1 over 2, minus 1. Okay, n over 2. Minus 1. Okay, so this isn't quite ELAP in squared, but it's very, very close. You can modify it a little bit, and by tweaking this or taking the product with the previous system, you can get ELAP in squared without much difficulty. So by the way, it's easy to see in the definition that if you take two null sequences and you add them or subtract them or multiply them, you get another null sequence. So this is another example of a null sequence. Third example. That's exactly how it works. Okay, so Heisenberg example. So now we take the full Heisenberg group. Okay, same lattice as before. Now the quotient space is a bit more complicated. It's equivalent as a set, though not topologically, to a set of all points x, y, z times gamma, where x, y, and z lie between 1 and 0. But you have to glue together the zeros and ones. It's not quite a three torus. I mean, topologically it is, but there's sort of a slight twisting to it. But you have something like this. So let me call this point x, y, z. Okay. If you let your group element be 1, alpha, gamma, 0, 1, 1, 1, and x is still the identity, say, and f is still this function x, y, z, let's say e to the 2 pi I y, for all y between 1 and 0. Okay. and all x, of course, as well, x, y, z, between 1 and 0, then if you do the calculation, you will find that the linear sequence here turns out to be e to the n squared alpha gamma, n minus 1 over 2 gamma minus n alpha fractional part n gamma. So you start seeing the emergence of these bracket polynomials appearing. And there's a theorem of Vitali and Halland, also Vitali and Lyman, that in fact any bracket polynomial expression can ultimately be expressed as some sort of piecewise no sequence of some. The function is only, it looks continuous, but it's actually only piecewise continuous, because when you transition from y plus 1 to minus 1 to 0, the way that these things are identified, it's actually a jump discontinuity. But anyway, okay, so these are all these no sequences, and it's also a theorem that every new sequence of this form has some constraint of this type involving an Erfmann progression. And many other patterns too. I mean, not just Erfmann progressions, also cubes and all kinds of other linear patterns. And hence, if you want to get asymptotics for progressions, you have to understand these new sequences. Now, different new sequences have different constraints. So, I mean, some of these forms are simple because, for example, these new sequences already influence progression of length 3, and so if you want to understand progression of length 3, say, you need to understand these guys. But these more complicated sequences, they don't have any constraints along progression of length 3, and so you don't need to deal with them to understand progression of length 3. And so the classical theory of the circle method deals entirely with these phases and doesn't see these guys, and it gets good results because these guys are not obstructing progression of length 3. But this guy and this guy turn out to be obstructing progression of length 4. And then for length 5, there's some cubic guys like this that are obstructing that too, and so on. In fact, basically, the step of the nilpotent group actually it determines exactly what patterns are being obstructed. Well, that's... Well,
you said with integer part of alpha and beta, and you have 1/16th of a time equation. I mean, is that what you're referring to when you said linear constraint?
It's a probabilistic constraint. It's a lack of uniform distribution. Okay, and so it doesn't necessarily prevent you from having any patterns, period, but it can distort the count, the asymptotic. Yeah. So if you're just interested in qualitative results, then you may be able, you don't need to deal with this. For example, my first paper with Ben, in which we established arbitrary long progressions of the primes, it was a semi-quantitative result. We had a bound, we had a lower bound, but we did not have an asymptotic on progression of primes, and we also did not deal with this issue. We did not see the null sequences, and because of that, there's just no way we could get an asymptotic. Okay, you sort of have to deal with this issue if you want to get asymptotics. Okay. So in fact, we formulated the conjecture. Almost finished the introduction. Okay, so we formulated a conjecture called the Mobius sequence conjecture. Never mind what the S is for now. It's not important for us. Oh, actually, it's mildly important. Okay, well. So the conjecture is that if you take any null sequence and you correlate it against the Mobius function and you take its average, then this thing should decay. It should decay faster than any power. If f is a Lipschitz null sequence, for technical reasons, you need to know Lipschitz, then it should decay faster than any power of the logarithm times the constant, which depends on A, and it will depend on the group and gamma, and it would depend on the Lipschitz constant of f. Although it's important for applications, it does not depend on g. It has to be uniform in g. Just like the original Davenport was uniform in alpha. It's rather important that this is... this is the conjecture. There's an s in here because... So normally the step of this important Lie group is called s. That's how many commutators you need to take before you actually get nothing. So like this is one step, these are two steps. It's analogous to the notion of degree for polynomials. And so there's a MNS is a statement that this is true for S-step null sequences. Okay. So the entire Hardy-Lieber Vinogradov circle method to count for questions of primes can be, one of the major ingredients is Bounds and exponential sums, which turns out to be equivalent to understanding MN1 for one step. And it relies in turn on the Siegel-Wolfrich theorem, which is essentially this theorem for zero-step null sequences, which essentially pictures periodic sequences. And then Yeah, okay. A few years ago, we were able to prove by rather direct computation just for two-step sequences. Okay, and the result I wanted to talk about in the last 10 minutes is that we can actually prove the whole thing. This conjecture, together with another conjecture which I will not talk about today, the Galois universe conjecture. So there's another conjecture which has nothing to do with number theory. It's a purely a statement of additive combinatorics, but I won't say it here because I don't have time. But we have a paper that says that if this conjecture is true and this other conjecture is true, then you can solve then Dixon's conjecture. This thing I have somewhere else. Okay. For all systems of primes of complexity S. Now, I also don't have time to define what complexity means. That's a whole interesting story in itself, actually. But I'll just say that this conjecture is partially solved as well. It's trivial for zero. For one, it's Fourier analysis. And so the Hardy-Littler circle method is essentially just combining this result and this result. That is the Hardy-Littler-Vinogradov method. A few years ago, Ben and I were able to prove this, and we are working very hard on the general case. But not yet. We don't have it yet. If it's true for all S, so for example, because we had it for 2 and 2, we were able to get asymptotic for, say, progression of 4. If we have both these conjectures for general S, that would imply that Dick's conjecture I said before is true for any system of linear equations, provided that it satisfies just one rather annoying condition, which is that that your system does not contain any equation that only involves two primes or one prime, two or less primes. So any system which has an equation like this, or secretly encodes an equation like this, if you have, for example, okay. So I can't design this off the top of my head, here's two equations and two unknowns. We can't solve this equation because if you subtract these two equations, if I've done it right, which I haven't, okay, it's got the twin prime conjecture embedded inside it. So any problem which secretly encodes a really interesting conjecture, like a twin prime conjecture, anything that involves only two primes, we can't solve. But any other system of equations that in which every linear combination of equations involves at least three primes, we'll be able to solve. So this includes, for example, asymptotic regressions, but many other patterns as well. Okay. So this is our main motivation. But also, if you have something like this, then by what I said before, this would definitely imply lots of results about the distribution of null sequences specialized to primes. Okay. But I don't have time just to explain exactly what that would say. Okay. So in the short time I have remaining, let me very, very quickly try to discuss how you try to prove such a thing. Okay. So there are two tools. I mean, there's three main tools. So there's what we call the major arc case. When this orbit is actually periodic. Or very close to periodic, which I want to define what that means. Okay, so if you have a periodic orbit, for example, if you take e to the alpha n, where alpha is rational, like 3/5 something, then you have a periodic guy here. And then what you can do is that you just split this into arithmetic regressions. Like if this is periodic mod 5, you just split this into its classes mod 5. You use something that I erased, the prime number theorem of arithmetic regressions. And the Siegel-Wolfers theorem, and you can get this from Siegel-Wolfers. Okay. But unfortunately, as a consequence, the bound is ineffective, at least for big A. And we do need, unfortunately, big A. Well, okay, we need A like 5 or something. Okay, it's already, okay. So no, actually, well, no, we actually do need quite large A. Actually, now I think about it. So. Okay, so that's one case. But this is in some sense a very small minority of cases. Okay, if you take arbitrary orbits in the manifold, they are usually not periodic at all. I mean, they are almost periodic. I don't know how close to periodic means. What it means is that sort of, if you look at the orbit over an interval length n, it stays very close to a periodic orbit for a long period of time. So it's like within one over n of a rational. Think of it for a small denominator, think of it like that. Okay, so that's the major R case. Then there's the equidistributed case. And that's when this orbit is the opposite of periodic. So here's a new manifold. Okay, if you have a periodic orbit, then of course you are not spreading out over the entire manifold. You're just stuck in a very small subset, a finite subset of this manifold. So there's an opposite case in which this guy is equidistributed. So it's actually spread out uniformly. We actually need something a bit stronger than equidistribution. We need what's called total equidistribution, which means that that in fact even if you dilate, if you restrict, say, to a residue class mod Q, it's still equidistributed. So there's no local obstructions, and we do need a very quantitative version of the total equidistribution. So equidistribution is a qualitative statement that given any box here, the number of points in the orbit, say from 1 up to n in this box, eventually converges to a ratio to n. But in order to get a good bound like this, and we need a good bound like this because we lose a log somewhere else, actually. And so we do need this good bounds. You need effective rates of convergence. But I have no time to talk about that. But so there's some equidistributed case. In that case, we use actually the same type of methods that were discussed in the previous talk last afternoon. Yeah, so we use the Vowel Differencing method, okay, which actually in our language we actually use a form of Van der Kolpert lemma, but it's essentially the same. It's essentially all Cauchy-Schwarz if you think about it that way. The Vowel Differencing plus some Fourier analysis. This comes first. Okay, so you do Fourier analysis. Okay, if you apply Vowel Differencing immediately, it doesn't work. You first apply Fourier analysis to try to simplify this function f. So in the one-step case, if you have a function on a torus, you would split it into characters. You use Fourier analysis to split it into exponentials, and then you apply Vowel Differencing to the exponentials. But you don't apply it to general functions. So it turns out that there's some for no sequences, for no manifolds, there's a weak form of Fourier analysis. You can use the center of the Noetherian group, and you can still do that's abelian. You can still do Fourier analysis on the center, and you can get some partial characters, what we call vertical characters, so you do that first. And the reason you do that is because that will create some cancellation when you do Vowel Differencing. It will lower, not quite the degree, but something like a degree. When you do the Vowel Differencing, you get a new sum which looks more complicated, but it's actually simpler. I just realized that what I'm talking about just not connected. Okay, this is actually going to point to something else. Let me return to that point. Okay, sorry, I got slightly confused. Let me put that on hold. So from the equidistributed case, we actually use a technique from number theory, it's called Vaughan's method. Also known as the method of type 1 and type 2 sums. Vinogradov's method, yeah. We use Vaughan's identity. Okay. We use Vaughan's version of Vinogradov's method. How about that? Okay. Thank you. Sorry? Okay. We can get that taking full advantage of the total equidistribution. But then we have to do the general case when you're not equidistributed and you're not major arc. So the orbit may not be periodic and may not be equidistributed. So it may instead be distributed in some other funny way, like it may be concentrating on some subset of your big set. Okay, but in that case we're able to we have this tool which we have a Ratner type theorem. For no systems. So random attack theorems are statements of the form that if you have some group quotient and you have some orbit acting on a quotient space, then the orbit under certain conditions on the group, which are similar to nilpotents but a bit more general, and on the group element, then the orbit can't just be arbitrary. The orbit actually has to always be concentrated in some closed subset, which is also a group quotient of something else. Okay, so the orbit closures of any orbit in your big quotient space, in fact, form a nice algebraic set. So they don't form a Cantor set or anything nasty. A nice algebraic set. So the example that you'll be most familiar with is that of a torus. So I'm sorry, I'll finish very soon. Okay, so if you take a torus and you look at a torus flow, just shifting by alpha. So if all the coefficients of alpha are rational, that gives you a finite orbit. If they are all irrational and incommensurable, so no linear combination of them is rational, then it's equidistributed. But there are intermediate cases. For example, if I look at x comma y goes to x plus root 2, y plus root 2, then the orbit then will get concentrated on some diagonals like this. And so that's an intermediate set, but this is still a torus. It's just an intermediate torus. And so there's a similar result for no manifolds, which in principle I think goes all the way back to Green, actually. Not my Green, but Leon Green. Sorry, Penn. Okay. My co-author. Okay. Anyway, there are these results about equidistribution, and we need a theorem like this, and we actually need a quantitative version of this. Okay, because we have a quantitative output, we need quantitative inputs. And that's slightly tricky, but the last thing I wanted to say, okay, so I didn't have time to cover this, but this is fairly standard. Okay, this is, actually, again, also Cauchy-Schwarz. But the Radner type theorem, the way we prove this, what this ends up doing, so we're, for Mobius sequences, we need to understand this expression, which is sort of complicated because there's two messy things here. There's the number theoretic part and the dynamical part. But to understand Radner type theorems, you only need to understand it has no number theory, this result, okay. You need to understand the average behavior of things like this. This is what you need to understand, equidistribution of GN. And this is a simple object. And the way we study this is we first use Fourier analysis, going back to this thing here, we first use Fourier analysis to decompose this as much as possible into what we call vertical characters, things with some nice Fourier-like behavior. Then we hit it with our differencing, and we get some cancellation. And we get something that looks messier because it actually lives on a product new manifold, and it looks like you're actually controlling a simple expression by a worse expression, but that worse expression happens to have lower degree in some sense than the original expression. So the third ingredient is the correct definition of degree. And this turned out to be rather hard. But it's a purely algebraic statement that given a no system, an orbit on a new manifold, there is a number you can associate it, which is analogous to the degree of a polynomial. And it has the property that if you hit it with vowel differencing, the vowel difference object has one less degree than what you started with. And so there's an algebraic lemma of that form. And if you have that, then you can iterate this and you can get this Radner theorem, which allows you, at the end of the day, it allows you to deduce the general case, reduces it to these two other cases, which you use the Siegel-Wolfrich theorem for here and the Vinogradov method for that. And that eventually gives you this. Okay, so I'm way over time, so thank you very much.